If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tastesofchicago.com to order today.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN. Elise Glink, the owner of Think Link Media and Best Money Moves, joins us. Hi, Elise.
Hey, John.
I wanted to talk about the National Association of Home Builders survey of where the people that do the work building homes are from. Before we get to that, though, I wanted you to just comment on the new credit card numbers, which are out. We don't mean credit card numbers. We mean the use of, the interest rates on, the debt that credit cards are carrying. What are you hearing about that?
So it's interesting. Obviously, the amount that people are borrowing using credit. And when we say credit, we don't just mean credit cards, of course. We mean personal loans. We mean mortgages. We need auto loans, student loans. All of that gets packed together. And today, people have borrowed nearly $5.1 trillion. That amount is significantly higher, 25% higher than it was in 2019 when they borrowed $4.2 trillion. So there's a really big difference. And when you look at sort of how people are borrowing that money, you've got revolving credit cards debt. It's revolving debt, but it's credit card debt, up 4.5% from where it was. Non-revolving is up 1.1%. That would be mortgages or car loans, things that are fixed, the same payment every month. If you look at the interest rates, it's dramatically different from where it was. And actually, what I had said in my notes to you, this may help explain why people feel so broke. They've borrowed more, and the interest rates are really different. So in 2019, people were paying for, let's say, a 60-month car loan or a 72-month car loan, right? They were paying 5.3%. Today, they're paying 8.4%. That's a big difference. Credit card interest rate, they were paying in 2019 15%. Today, it's almost 22%. Personal loans, 10% versus 12%. It makes a big difference.
That credit card number is a big one, isn't it?
It is. I mean, this idea that people are carrying, I think it's now an average of about $7,000 or $8,000 of credit card debt for people who have debt. It's a really big number. And if you're starting to pay 21, 22% interest on that, that's a big monthly nut.
I don't know what the solution to that is. I don't know what the solution to that is. I don't know if that requires federal intervention or people just to get some common sense. But sometimes they know that this is going to be a heavy lift for them, but they got to get groceries or they got to get their car fixed or they got to get shoes for their kids. So they put it on a credit card and they pay 22%. A bank or a lending institution should be paid for the use of money. I get that. But it seems to me like 22% should be against the law, especially since the highest rates are charged to the people who can least afford it. If you have better credit scores, then your home loans and your car loans and your credit card rates are all smaller. And then they take the people that are a higher risk. I know you know all this, but the people that are a higher risk who have less income and have less creditworthiness, they're a higher risk. So then they charge them more for the privilege of borrowing the money, which is just a vicious cycle. It repeats itself then.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, when you look at the whole buy now, pay later industry, and it is an industry, right? This is Klarna and the likes of it, where people, you know, they don't pay any interest unless they miss a payment. And what they're basically doing is you're agreeing to repay over, let's say, 4 or 6 payments. And if you miss one, then you get really walloped with it. But you can see why people are considering that in droves. 35% of people are considering applying for a buy now, pay later loan. The average purchase amount is $132. So it's not like they're getting a credit card, right? I mean, a car, they're buying small items.
$132.
That's $132 that they then agree to pay off over 4 or 6 payments.
You know, it's interesting that you say all that because we have plenty of products we sell on this radio station which give you the option of a year of no interest and or no payments. You could do that for a year. And I don't blame anybody for taking advantage of that as long as you can get square in 12 months. That's not inherently a bad idea if you can afford it. You know, save your money. But if you can't, then that lure is dangerous for those people, isn't it?
Well, it is, because if you miss a payment, and this is true with buy now, pay later, it's true with your credit card, the interest rate shoots up. So you might go from 0% to 25% or 32%. You know, you're going to pay a huge penalty for missing that one payment. A lot of people don't recognize that or realize it as they're doing the charging, or they feel like they don't have any other options. So they go through with it.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're talking to Elise Glink about the business of home building. So what have you got for us on that, Elise?
You know, I think people don't realize how many times their homes are built, painted, carpeting installed. Construction is actually done by people who are immigrants. And the way that this works is that the concentration of immigrants is particularly high for all facets of home building, right? So plasterers and stucco masons, immigrants are 64% of that workforce, 52% of drywall ceiling tile installers, 48% of painters, 47% of roofers, 46% of carpet floor tile installers. And, you know, all in, it looks like they're between 30 and 40%, you know, overall. But in Texas and in California, 40% of the construction workforce is immigrants. Now, what portion of that are here illegally, meaning without a, you know, a green card or being married into, you know, being a citizen, is a little less certain, right? Because everybody provides what's in, you know, they all have to have their identities checked, but it's very common for people who are not in this country legally to buy and share, you know, social security numbers, which actually means they're paying into social security but never get a dime out of it. That's a different discussion. But given that the existing construction market is very tight, if even 20% of the construction crews are not in this country legally, they would disappear and you would have a very hard time starting to build houses, yeah, to build them, because literally the labor force that's there wouldn't be there anymore. One of the things that's so interesting about this is that Texas and Florida are two of the places where we see, and we talked about this, I don't know if it was last week or a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how Texas and Florida are the two states that have the largest numbers of U.S. people moving there from other places, right? Illinois or New York, losing people, Texas and Florida gaining people, but they also have as many as, you know, 40% of people who are building those houses for all those new residents who may not be there under a deportation event. So it was just interesting to look at those numbers this week.
Immigrants make up about 40% of the construction workers in the Lone Star State. And if you say even 20% of them are undocumented, then that'll put a real crimp on it. It's interesting because as much as we talk about the high price of homes or how difficult it is to get a house for people, especially that maybe first or second house that's a little lower priced, if you've got $1 million and you want to buy a $1 million home, you can pay with the cash, you don't have to worry about it. But two of the things that have been stalling home purchasing for people is interest rates and availability. If we lose a high percentage of the people making homes, the supply side is going to still stay small. That'll still be harder to get in. It'll still make houses expensive.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how we're already not building nearly enough homes to just stay even with the increase in the number of households in this country. If you think about what number really needs to be there to start to eat away at that shortage that we've talked about many times, you'd probably have to build somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million homes a year. We're now not even building 1 million homes a year in this country. And it's less than it was way before the pandemic. So if we're not even building enough to stay even, I'm not quite sure where everybody's going to be living. But this is going to be one of those things that has a direct impact. And it's what the incoming administration has said is going to be like day one. They're going to start putting this into play. And I think it's going to be quite disruptive for the real estate industry.
If in fact it happens, I think like a lot of things, tariffs or the massive migration or deportation issues, sometimes that's seen as a negotiating chip. It's something you say, but you you won't do, or maybe you can't possibly do? How, in fact, do you find and then grab and then export millions of people? How long would that take? At what cost? And do we even want that? And I think I was thinking about the jobs that Brenda and I have had done around our home. We have a condo in the city, just a little small one that I mostly stay in. And then we have a little bit of a larger home in Ottawa. When people have come to paint, drywall, plumb, you know, more than half of those people are foreign-born or from foreign-born families. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of people look the other way when they wonder about the migrant status of people. The landscapers that come to our house, they don't speak English. One guy on the crew does. How does that happen? Who these people are? Nobody wants to know. We don't ask. We just say, that was a great deal, and thank you very much. And that's the kind of economy we've all agreed to.
Yeah.
That's not a question. I'm sorry. I'm just rambling now.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's exactly right. But I think you know, the question I get asked all the time, John, is, well, why is it that those people know how to do all these things, right? Why is my painter from Italy, for example? Around the world, people actually build their own homes. If you travel at all and you get outside the major cities, what you see are people who, as money and time permit, will build a second story. They'll start with, you know, the structure, and then they add some bricks, and then they get some more money, and they add some cement, and then they go through it. And they're actually literally building it themselves with their family members. And so they have those skills, and they bring those with them to this country. And we've all benefited from it for decades. It's just how it's been.
It does seem to align with certain nationalities or parts of the world, too. The Polish guy did the floor. The Mexican-American guys or the Mexican guys did the landscaping. It's interesting how it kind of falls into those slots. Maybe it's cultural. It's passed on from one family to the next. Maybe it's, like you said, how they live. They do their own work. But we do benefit from it here. And I'm interested in these numbers. So you say immigrants account for 30% of all workers in construction trades. I'm surprised it's that low, but that's at least one number, according to the NHL.
Yeah, that's the Census Bureau and the National Association of Home Builders estimate. So they do think it's somewhere between 30 and 40%, definitely 40 or even more, 40% or more in places like Texas and Florida. And it is the sort of the undercurrent of what's going on in our construction industry for commercial as well as residential. So something to watch out for and think about if you're renovating next year or planning to build a house. You'll have to plan in advance.
Well, I just got a text message from a friend of ours who is in the roofing business, and I know he knows his trade. And he said 90% of the roofers are Hispanic, and that's been our experience, too. Jim Dahlke regularly joins us Mondays, Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative, as we talk about angel investing, technology, and more. Boy, it's interesting the way the internet and apps are being used. Chicago Startup Fellow raises $10 million for what purpose, Jim? Welcome back.
Hey, John. Yeah, this is a startup that's all about combating loneliness. Fellow, spelled F-E-L-L-O, is really all about helping users find other people who are going through something similar. I think we can all admit that if we're feeling a little lonely, we feel a little less lonely when we connect with somebody who maybe has gone through what we've experienced in the past or is going through it currently. And that's really what Fellow is all about. It's this platform for connecting you with others who may be going through something similar, whether it's with a relationship, a parenting issue, drug and alcohol use. Really, Fellow's goal here is to connect folks with others who are going through the same thing. They just raised $10.4 million in new funding. So a nice chunk of change here at the end of the year for a startup, Fellow, which is recently came out of stealth mode. They say that they've already got thousands of users who've signed up connecting with others on its platform. And so you can expect this company to continue to grow with some money in the bank.
How does it work? Do you know?
Yeah. So basically what they do is the app is kind of an alternative to traditional therapy. So with kind of 30-minute video check-in for users, costs about $40. And then on the other side of the coin, users can actually earn up to $56 an hour for sharing their stories after they're vetted and trained by the platform. So basically, it's connecting you with vetted folks on the other end who have quality experience in the areas that you're struggling with. And so, like I mentioned, it could be an issue that you've got with parenting. It can issue with that you've got in a relationship, or maybe you're just struggling with substance abuse. And so, this platform is not necessarily connecting you with professional, but really somebody who's kind of been in your shoes before.
There's another platform originating in Chicago that would connect people who need friendship or companionship, and you would meet at the park and do yoga, or you would, find common interests and then meet those people through an app. But this is more get expert guidance from somebody, right?
That's right. And the startup that you just mentioned is called Pi, the one that we've talked about before, which is really all about connecting people, creating friendships. And, I don't think it's a coincidence, right, that we're kind of seeing the rise in these types of technology platforms and apps following the COVID pandemic. I think, obviously, COVID left a lasting remark on many of us and changed, the way we go about the world and the way we work and the way we meet people. And so I think it's certainly not a surprise that we've seen technology companies kind of launch in response to that, and venture investors are seeing the need as well. $10 million for Fellow certainly significant. We've talked about Pi, which is another Chicago-based app led by Andy Dunn. It's raised over $20 million in venture funding as well. So it's not just the entrepreneurs, but also the venture capitalists are getting behind this idea as well.
Yeah, I see how the human connection is important and how this could be a conduit for that. But it is also a little ironic that the reason I think a lot of us are lonely or isolated is because we're on our devices and phones. So now the solution is get your device or phone out and find human beings. But if it comes around, it comes around. Talk to me about Current. This is a Chicago-based company. What's this all about?
Yeah, Current is a local startup and innovation hub that's really all about water and water innovation, and kind of new ways of using water and harnessing new insights from that. And they just received over $360,000 from JP Morgan Chase, which are going to help it fund some different new educational and sustainable workforce development programs. Current has raised several million dollars over the last few years, and it's really looking to kind of be this really valuable water resource for Chicago's business community. Among Current's goals is finding ways to separate minerals such as lithium and other dangerous chemicals from wastewater. They also launch and invest in water tech startups themselves. So, water is going to be a big factor in the AI boom that we're seeing. Water is a main resource to cool these data centers that are kind of key to the AI infrastructure here, really, take up a lot of energy and need to be cooled down, and water is one resource to do that. So we're certainly seeing a lot of momentum in the water innovation space, and Chicago could be potentially poised to play a large role in that. So the more funding for Current as they look to continue to grow their resources.
One more story. Tell us about the BioHub in Chicago.
Yeah, so the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, this is a big a biotech initiative that launched in Chicago earlier this year. As a reminder, this was a $250 million hub here. They chose Chicago as one of their four hubs across the U.S. So it was a big get for Chicago when this hub launched here. And some big news out of the BioHub here, they published their first major scientific research paper detailing a new implantable sensor they've developed that can monitor inflammation in real time. So you think of this kind of similar to the idea of sort of continuous glucose monitoring, helping diabetes patients track their blood sugar. But instead of a glucose monitor, this is all about inflammation. So it's important in arthritis and cancer, heart failure, kidney failure, all of that tied to inflammation. So really interesting technology here and a good first step for the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub here in Chicago.
Yeah, we got to run. I'd like to know more about that, though. Is it inflammation of the arteries or the tissues and joints? I wonder where it is sensing the inflammation.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So, the team created these sensors that consist of a quart of the DNA then a larger piece of the DNA on the other end to bind a desired protein. So it's all about tracking the proteins and across a range of different health outcomes.
That's a longer conversation another day. Fascinating. Glad to see that research happening in Chicago. Always nice to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, Sean.
Jim Dahlke is the Director of Communication at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. More business news. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Illinois ranks among the weakest states for wage growth. According to a new report, ADP Pay Insight says state employees saw a 4.5% increase in wages from November 2023 to this year. That's below the national average of 4.8%. Illinois ranked 48th for wage growth. According to this analysis, Illinois' median salary was $56,700, just below the national average of $59,200. Workers who switched jobs saw the highest wage gains in November, up 7.2% year over year. Illinois is also trailing the nation in job growth. Chicago-based dairy company Fairlife and its parent company Coca-Cola are consolidating their local offices in Fulton Market. Cranes reports the companies are finalizing a lease for about 37,000 square feet of space at 910 West Lake. That six-story building is the vacant Lake Street Lofts. The residential units are being turned into offices. Coca-Cola will relocate from 1201 West Lake, and Fairlife will relocate from 1001 West Adams. It's unclear when the moves will happen. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Business of Food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And how about this for a statistic about the men and women who grow our food?
96% of our respondents in our survey reported that they were current drinkers.
And the number for the general population?
85% are current drinkers compared to 96% of farmers.
More about booze on the farm after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. On the phone is
Dr. Christina Proctor. I am a clinical associate professor in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia.
Christine says she and her people did interviews with farmers nationwide and found a common reason for the excess drinking: stress and the lack of mental health care.
It's concerning because it is such a stressful job, and then you live in these areas where you don't have any access to care, right? And where alcohol is a more acceptable way to cope with stress than actually talking to someone about the problems that you're facing.
Or put another way,
it's easier to go to the beer store than ask for help, a direct quote from one of our farmers.
And while people in the city may catch a couple of drinks after work, it's different on the farm where people not only work, they live.
They would tell us that they're not consuming like while they're actually working, but then if things came up, like they might have a drink and then a cow gets out and they have to go, you know, fix that, or a piece of equipment malfunctions. Well, they have to handle that.
And
a farmer's day never ends, right? There's so many things that can come up.
Plus,
there were some findings that sort of shocked us.
Such as?
We actually found that our female farmers were more likely to binge drink than our male farmers. 23.4% binge drank on a weekly or a daily basis.
And the irony? Without farmers, there'd be no booze. Yeah, be careful out there. Take care. On the food calendar, it's National Pastry Day, and it's, oh boy, it's National Lutefisk Day, a Christmas treat for the Norwegians and Swedes among us. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Larry Chester joins us again here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We've talked with him in the past about how he has taken executives and found almost second lives for them. Larry is the founder and CEO now of Back Office Simplified. Larry, welcome back. You're on WGN.
Hey, John, it's great to see you. Thanks very much.
So talk to me about your business model that you had and how this new one is similar.
Well, John, you know, I worked as a fractional CFO for 18 years under CFO Simplified, and CFO Simplified still operates. But what I found was that there were so many people that were moving into the fractional market. They wanted the independence of working for themselves. They wanted the flexibility of being able to develop a work-life balance of their own. And so they have this skill, whether it be in finance or in IT or in human resources or in marketing. There's so many different areas. And so they've gone out and hung out their own shingle and have worked as a fractional executive for many companies at the same time.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they've they've developed the skill that they're putting out there, but there are a lot of other things that go into having a business besides just going out and working in your trade.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you have to have an accounting system to keep track of your billing and the cash receipts coming in. You have to have business insurance to make sure that you're protected against general liability, professional liability, cyber protection. You've got to have group health insurance to be able to protect yourself and your family. You've got to have managed IT services to be able to make sure that your laptop and your computer are working the way they should. And you have to have a CRM to make sure that a customer relationship management program to make sure that you can track the companies that you're working with. And so Back Office Simplified was put together to really provide those services, all five of those critical services, for fractional workers who don't really have the time or want to take the time to go out and research all those different areas and sign up for them by themselves.
It might be a different skill set anyway. So when you started CFO Simplified, where you were getting chief financial officers to work fractionally for businesses and help them out, did you anticipate that it would grow at such a level that these fractional CFOs need themselves support to do the business they're doing? Was this an extension of the first business that you anticipated?
No, I didn't anticipate it. And I think that's the big key, is that, you know, everybody thinks that you can work as an independent contractor and provide services for people. And when I started my fractional practice, I worked initially as myself, and then I started hiring people, and they were being hired as independent contractors. They paid their own taxes. They took care of themselves. They dealt with all the problems they had to deal with. But then I found out that I really needed to provide those services for them so that they could spend time worrying about the clients that they were servicing and not worrying about whether they had insurance protection or worried right. about whether they had health insurance or any of those other things.
Larry, so describe for me some of the businesses that use the services of either company, I guess. Who are the companies that need these fractional executives to help them out?
Well, you know, with the fractional market has grown so much that there are 15, they said that there are now 59 million people working as fractional workers in this country. And it really runs the gamut of all kinds of businesses, but it's primarily in the lower middle market, those companies that are anywhere from, let's call it, $2 to $50 million a year in sales, where they don't have the money to be able to hire skilled executives, whether that be in marketing or in IT or in human resources or in finance, to work full-time for them. And they don't need somebody full-time in any one of those areas. So they go out into the market and they find fractional workers, people who are working for two, three, four, five different companies at the same time, providing those services for them, for that business owner.
Yeah,
so that
right.
he doesn't have to worry about it, doesn't have to worry about finding somebody who is going to solve their human resources problems or provide them with financial reports at the end of the month.
Right, but if
and that could be anything from advertising agencies to manufacturing companies.
Okay, but is the service that these fractional workers are providing, that you are helping, are they CFOs or do they have other positions in a company where they would advise?
No, they cover every single functional area within a business. Human resources, executives who are VPs of human resources, vice presidents of IT, marketing.
Yeah. Okay, but then what about
those
this?
Areas.
And then what? So maybe I'm trying to think of the job I would have where I would use those services. I'm a plumber, or I'm a home and decorator, or I'm a maybe I'm a an Uber driver. I don't know. Uber driver wouldn't be an example, but I mean, what wouldn't it be an example of a small business that isn't big enough to have its own full-time CFO or IT director, but needs those services?
Well, there are small consulting companies that work in engineering support, that work in providing support for companies that are too small to hire a full-time human resources director. But they still have the problems of dealing with the compliance issues of having employees.
Yeah.
Well, if they don't have somebody who's there to answer the questions on a daily basis, how do they get those answers? So that's where that comes from. And these business owners know that they have these problems, and those problems crop up from time to time. It may not be every day, you know, that they need somebody, but once a month, month or every couple of months. They need somebody who can fix their laptop or somebody who can tell them what they should do to protect their IT services, their laptop and their computers from cybercrime.
Well, it's that back office stuff that is sometimes the difference between make it or break it as a company. Larry Chester, therefore, the founder and CEO, came up with Back Office Simplified, backofficesimplified.com. We're out of time today, Larry.
That's right.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, John.